Hello, and welcome to a Galt-free Quantum Leap. Coming up, the equinox and the equinoctial weather we've been having, how to keep your voicemail messages secure, plus we'll be dissecting some Junior Cert science, and don't forget our competition to win an iPod Nano. But first, some hot air, carbon dioxide emissions to be precise. Now, among all the other things happening here this week, you may have missed the fact that this is International Energy Awareness Week. But a report published yesterday by the Environmental Protection Agency shows that Ireland's carbon dioxide emissions are continuing to grow way above our Kyoto limits. In fact, in 2004 alone, they increased by a staggering 23%. And of course, with that, our dependence on fossil fuels is also growing. So wouldn't it be wonderful if we could wave a wand and convert the carbon dioxide waste back into a useful carbon fuel? Well, it might sound like chemical magic, but according to a report in this week's New Scientist, researchers in Italy are trying to do just that. Correspondent Rob Edwards joins me now from Edinburgh with the story. Rob, what's the big idea?
The big idea, really, is to complete the cycle, burn carbon, create carbon dioxide, and then turn carbon dioxide back into hydrocarbons, which can themselves be used as fuel. It's been a holy grail of scientists for some years, but these scientists in Italy really think they've made progress in making it achievable.
You make it sound very simple. I'm guessing, since it hasn't been done yet, that it's anything but.
You're right. Of course, it's not simple. What they've managed to do is to, using a photocatalytic process involving nanotechnology, to get some hydrocarbons out of carbon dioxide. But they've only managed to do it at a small percentage, 1 or 2%. In order to make it viable, they obviously have to do it at a much higher percentage. Now, they say that with development and with money, that might be achievable within a decade or so. So this is not instant magic, but it's something that they argue is well worth researching and could give us a useful way of recycling the waste carbon dioxide that we get from burning fossil fuels into more fuels.
It does sound really attractive. Are they trying to make something light like natural gas from the carbon dioxide, or something heavier like oil or petrol?
They're talking about making oil and petrol, because the kind of heavy hydrocarbons you get, they say, are suitable for that. So, you know, we could be using carbon dioxide to put the diesel or petrol into our motors in 20 years' time, if these guys are right.
My gosh. Now, you mentioned a couple of words I want to come back to. One was nanotechnology, and where does that come into this?
They use nanotechnology to produce, in a catalyst, they use tiny, tiny particles of platinum palladium in carbon nanotubes, which are used as a catalyst to convert the CO2 into the carbon hydrocarbons that are included in it. And they say using these tiny particles in the carbon nanotubes enables them to increase the efficiency and get more hydrocarbons out of it.
If I understand you right, what they're doing is they're whipping the oxygen away from the carbon dioxide and replacing it with hydrogen. The other term that you used in describing what they're doing that I want to come back to is photocatalytic. Now, I'm guessing this means solar power, because presumably it's no good if we were actually using fossil fuels in this process to try and make fossil fuels.
No, part of the dream, or part of the ambition of these scientists, is to use solar power to split water to start the process. You're right, if you use fossil fuel to do it, it would be counterproductive, because you'd just be burning more fossil fuel and creating more waste. But if you're able to use solar power as you say, a photocatalyst to split the water in the first part of the process, you're obviously, you know, carbon neutral in that sense, not increasing the amount of carbon. So you're actually recycling the waste that's created by the burning of fossil fuels.
It does sound like something like a holy grail, taking a carbon dioxide waste and solar power to turning it back into a useful fuel. I'm guessing it can't come too soon. I see a report in this week's Nature. The Science Journal reveals that the Greenland ice sheet is melting even faster than people had thought, and I think three times faster in the last couple of years than in the previous 2 years. But you're saying, I think, something, we might have a commercial version of this within a decade. What's the international reaction to this? But do people think this is hope, or is it hype?
People think it's hope, but it's not a magic wand that will solve the problem. And it's certainly not going to solve the entire problem. And it certainly should not be used, in my view, as an excuse for, you know, not reducing our carbon dioxide emissions now. But it's worth researching. I spoke to a couple of other scientists who weren't involved in this research, but they were all cautiously enthusiastic about it. You said it's got some problems to solve, it needs to increase its efficiency, it needs to demonstrate its that it's going to be sufficiently economic, it won't be too expensive, but it's well worth researching because it might give us a way of recycling the waste carbon dioxide in the future.
So on that cautiously optimistic note, thank you, Rob Edwards. And mention of the nanotechnology and the nanocatalyst brings me neatly to our nanotechnology competition. Tell us your thoughts about nanotechnology, the hype, the hope, the implications for Ireland in no more than 300 words. And we'll be giving an iPod Nano for the most considered response. And even if you don't know or think you don't know anything about nanotechnology, we'd like to know what it is you might have picked up from listening to programmes like this or from reading the media. And the closing date is September 30th. One of the perennial problems that surfaces on this and other programmes is how to encourage young people to take up science as a career. Right across the developed world, students are turning their backs on science subjects at second and at third level. Well, there might be a slight ray of hope in last year's junior cert results, which showed an improvement in the science and maths grades. And this year was also the first year that students were examined in a new science syllabus. We sent Terry Flanagan to see what's behind the statistics.
Good morning, everyone. As you are aware, the junior certificate results were published on Wednesday. There were an excellent set of results from Hyde Park College. Congratulations to all the students and teachers concerned. Well done.
And one of those successful students joins me now, James White. Congratulations, you've just got your results. How did you do?
Quite well, thank you very much. Everything really that I had expected, very pleased with my results, so quite happy with that.
And you're now in transition year?
Yes, transition year programme in Moyle Park.
And what about science? You're doing science?
Yes, science transition year.
You enjoying it?
Yes, it's quite interesting. Different things so far about biology and habitats, animal habitats and conservation.
Good. When you leave school, I presume you're thinking of college, would you think of a science degree?
Not particularly, no. At this moment in time, I'm more interested in politics and law and that sort of area to go into college to do perhaps law in Trinity. I've already been looking to see about points wise and different things like that that are needed to get into Trinity. So I'm pretty set in that. Science as a subject after school, I think for myself it's not really feasible. I feel that as well it's a hard profession to succeed in. It's a very tiresome one and there's very few opportunities as well for scientists to be able to practice their work.
So your heart and soul is set on politics and law?
Yeah, very much so.
Eugene Delaney, you're a science teacher here in Moyle Park College and you've been here for what, well in excess of 20 years. So you have taught the new course, but you've also taught the old course, the old inter-cert course and the junior cert course. What's so different about this new course?
Well, in the old course, there was no requirement for the students to have done any practicals, Terry. It would have been a help, of course, and every teacher did try in so far as they could to make sure that all students were exposed to as many practicals as they could. But nowadays, there's actually built into the exam system is a module for experiments. So the students have to do experiments, which is great. You know, science is a subject that you should live and you should do and work at. You know, it's very difficult to expect students to really get a grasp of science merely by reading the books. It's a bit like trying to get the flavour of a cake by just reading the recipe. So it's great that we're now into a situation where we have students living the subject.
So that if anybody goes into a lab now, they want to see kids hands-on doing experiments.
Well, you are, and there are a list of prescribed experiments which they must do. So it's a much noisier place now. It's a much more active place. It's just a hive of activity now. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the past, because of the small amount of experiments the students would have been doing, it was maybe a quieter, but not maybe as an exciting or as a fun place to be.
So it's better nowadays, is that what you're saying?
Oh, I think so. I think it's a much better. Towards when, say, you or I were in school, when, you know, we were lucky if we ever saw the inside of a lab, not to mind an experiment. The students now are doing the experiments, which is great.
Are there any drawbacks?
Well, the drawbacks, not for the students, certainly it's all a plus and it's all very good for the students, but for the teachers, certainly the workload has increased enormously, because if you take your average teacher of science, he or she has maybe four or five science groups a week doing practicals. That's a lot of preparation, and it's a lot of work ordering and restocking, because kids being kids, you know, things break. It's a lot of work. We're tireder, that's what I would think.
So you're happy then with the new course, Eugene, or could it be improved even further, do you think?
Well, I'm not so sure about the course. I'm pretty happy with the course at the moment, but certainly we wouldn't say no to maybe assistance, you know, with the workload that teachers are facing, and particularly with the tight schedule we have in terms of, you know, we must be out of the lab and cleaned up by the time our next teacher comes in with his or her group. Certainly some kind of move towards having school lab technicians would be a great help.
Minister of Education, Mary Hanafin, TD. Lots of happy people there. Could I ask you a question? Are you happy?
I'm very happy that the students and teachers are happy with the new syllabus, because obviously if teachers are happy teaching it and the students enjoy actually learning it, it will encourage them to take a greater interest in science and to be able to continue it on for Leaving Cert and into the future. And of course, seeing the good results this year in the Junior Cert, I think should encourage more and more people as well.
But are you concerned with the perception among students or certain students that science is a difficult subject, it's hard to get points at, and they're not taking it up at Leaving Cert level, and worse still, they're not taking it up in college?
Yeah, I would be concerned, and in fact it's a concern we've had for a number of years with science. It has always had this image of being very, very difficult. I think now though, with the new curriculum at primary level, that we're actually going to get more students coming in who are inquisitive and curious and anxious to be learning more and more about what they do in science, because it's now an integral part of the new curriculum there. But then there's another gap between getting people beyond Junior Cert up to Leaving Cert. I love to see students doing biology, but concerned that we've only 14 and 15% doing physics and chemistry.
The numbers of physics and chemistry are very, very poor.
They're traditionally very low. And they remain very low. And it is a great concern to us as a government, because we have set out an investment programme in science and technology, engineering, innovation, right up for the next number of years, because that's where we know that the job opportunities are going to be. But maybe knowing that there are employment opportunities will encourage students as well.
And do you feel with this new course, this new hands-on Junior Cert course, that it will encourage school children to take it on at Leaving Cert level?
Well, the one thing I always encourage students to do when I was teaching, and will still do the same, is choose subjects that you enjoy doing and that you like, because if you enjoy doing something, you're going to be good at it. And there's no doubt students have enjoyed the Junior Cert science, so that should give them great hope for the Leaving Cert one.
Now, science has become a much more hands-on subject, but the teachers will tell you, why haven't we got lab technicians in the room? We need them.
Because science is not the only practical subject in the school. We have woodwork and metalwork at the moment, and that's being replaced with a brand new technology subject coming in next year, 07. We'd also have practical subjects like home economics and right across the spectrum. And I know that it would have a knock-on effect on those practical subjects, that they would be looking for technicians and for other support as well. It's also, of course, hugely costly. So while we have invested in the curriculum and we'll continue to invest in upgrading the labs in schools, which I'm very anxious to continue to do, and hopefully supporting teachers with in-service training in the immediate future, I don't see myself in a position to be able to do the technicians. But that's not to say that it's not on the cards for the future.
Where do you see the future of science education in Ireland at secondary level in the next 10 or 15 years?
I see it as being hugely important for the future economic development. We're looking now at the future skills needs for Ireland right up to 2020. And we need our young people to have the skills that they can gain in science, but also to have the education and training which will enable them to be able to avail of the new opportunities. One only has to look at the major investors in this country, and they're looking for highly skilled graduates, and they're looking for them in the technical and in the science areas. So the support for teachers, for schools, and the encouragement of young people in our schools to be able to take a course that is interesting and exciting is something that I would see as a priority over the next number of years. But I really want young people to look not just at the name science and to develop a block against it, not just to decide in advance I won't like or I won't be able for physics and chemistry, but to see it as a subject where they can build on the knowledge that they've now learnt and enjoyed at Junior Cert and to be able to take them much further.
So the future is bright. I suppose in one sense you could say the future is orange.
I believe the future is very bright. I mean, I'm one of those people many years ago who did physics and chemistry for my leaving cert and never did it afterwards. But what we need to do is to make sure that people like me don't drop it after leaving cert, but in fact continue even further. And undoubtedly we have recognised that the future economic prosperity of this country is going to be largely based on science and technology. And if young people want to be a part of that, to contribute to that and to benefit from it, then they're going to need their science.
Terry Flanagan there, reporting on this year's Junior Certificate Science Exam. You're listening to The Quantum Leap with me, Mary Mulvihill. Now, without going into the gory details, and by all accounts, they were pretty gory, the recent publishing of a private voicemail message on the internet was a reminder to us all that what we might think of as a private communication can end up being very public indeed. Well, twink members of the British Royal Family and public personalities such as David Beckham and his wife Victoria have all seen their voicemail messages put into the public domain. So much so, I'm told, that Victoria Beckham would leave a special message for those accessing her voicemail. So how is this possible? Is it legal or illegal? Well, I'm joined in studio by Adrian Weckler, editor of the Sunday Business Post's Computers in Business magazine. Adrian, it's obviously is possible for other people to access your voicemail box.
Yeah, there's one quick and easy way which people who try to access other people's voicemails on mobile phones and increasingly on landlines as well use. This isn't a secret, so I hope we're being responsible here. Basically, when you try to dial into your mobile voicemail from another phone, the common technique is to put a 5 between the first three digits, in other words 087 or 086 or 085, and the last 7 digits. Now, when you do that, you get right into your voicemail. You then press hash, and it will then prompt you for your PIN number, your voicemail PIN number, which you put in. However, if you haven't set your own PIN number, the default code PIN number is 0000. Now, there are believed to be still a substantial amount of people who haven't yet programmed their own PIN number, so they still have 0000 as their default PIN. The mobile operators can't tell us exactly how many, because I asked them, but it's anecdotally, it could be as much as 10 or 20%. It's likely that it probably affects people, older people, people over the age of 45, 50, who have only recently started to use mobile phones.
So the first thing anyone should do now, once the programme has ended, is go and change the PIN.
That's
and
right.
Set it to their own.
In fairness to the mobile operators, they do place a message on their voicemail service for their customers the first time that their customers use the service, prompting them to actually set their own password. But it's simply not known. They simply don't know how many people have done this. Now, this is a technique that is well known and well used among security personnel, detectives, even some tabloid journalists are known to use this as an easy technique to try and find out what somebody has been up to. You may only have a 1 in 6 or a 1 in 10 or even maybe a 1 in 20 chance of succeeding with it, but it's worth the risk if you're of that kind of a mind.
Would you know if it has been done to you?
You would if you went into your voicemail and it told you that you had no new voice messages but that you had one or two old voice messages but you hadn't listened to them before. You may become suspicious. However, it's unlikely that you'll even have old voice messages left, because the phone tapper will probably just delete the messages after they've listened to them, which they are perfectly capable of doing from any touch tone phone.
Is there any difference between landlines and mobiles in this context?
There used
at
to
all?
Be a huge difference. Mobiles have always operated on a digital voicemail system. Now landlines are starting to do the same thing. For example, Aircom or BT Ireland landline messaging service or voicemail services are now using exactly the same kind of technique as the mobile phone operators. Now, if you haven't set your own PIN code, once again, there's a default code for landlines. It's 1234. Now, again, I was on to Aircom to ask them how many people have actually done this. They don't know, but they could tell me that 500,000 people in Ireland, 500,000 Aircom customers have this service. So it's a fair bet that a substantial proportion of them haven't yet set their security voicemail PIN numbers.
What are the legalities of this?
It's absolutely illegal to do that. We've seen that from a number of instances over the last 20 years. It was clearly established that it's illegal for the state to tap phones of journalists or anybody else. But we've also seen more recently in cases concerning private individuals in the construction industry and allegations of phone tapping there in marital disputes. One of the side issues to come out of that was the legality of tapping into a mobile phone or a landline and the voicemail of both. It's covered basically under two or three of the Telecommunications Acts. It's codified now in one Telecommunications Act. But yeah, it's absolutely illegal.
It's absolutely illegal. On a not unrelated note, how easy is it to, I mean, you talked about tapping into phones, but to eavesdrop on phone conversations? It's been a while since, I think it was some of the English royals again, their voicemail, their mobile phone conversations were being eavesdropped on. And I'm wondering too about, say, all the cordless phones that people have in their homes now. Is it easy to eavesdrop into
those? It's much more difficult to do that. It used to be quite easy with the analogue phones because they operated on a certain frequency, a fairly narrow band frequency, and if you knew that much, it was quite easy to tap into those conversations. It's much more difficult to do that now because the digital sets that are used commonly now in landlines and mobiles, they not only do they have encryption, but they spread the bandwidth and the frequencies and the radio spectrum frequencies much more widely, so it's much more difficult to tap into them.
Much more difficult, but presumably one should still be careful what you say.
Absolutely.
Okay, and if you do want to say something very private, go to a noisy place and make sure nobody's wearing a wiretap.
Whisper it.
Whisper it, okay. Thank you very much. That's Adrian Weckler, editor of Computers and Business magazine. Thank you. Now, Saturday, the 23rd of September, will be the autumn equinox. But what exactly is an equinox? And is there really unusual equinoctial weather at this time of the year? Well, joining me in studio is meteorologist Gerry Fleming from Met Éireann. And on the line from NUI Maynooth is Emily Duffy, a keen amateur astronomer and physics student. Emily, can I come to you first?
Sure.
What is an equinox?
Well, the equinox actually gives itself away in the name because it comes from the Latin for equal night. So what it actually is, it's the time in the year when the day is the same length as the night. Now, it only happens for one day and the night that comes straight after it, and they're the same length. Now, it happens next Saturday, as you said, and more technically, the equinox is actually the exact moment when the sun is over the equator. Now, in our time, that happens at 4 o'clock in the morning, so I wouldn't recommend anyone stays up for it. You won't notice anything. And after the equinox, what happens is we start noticing winter getting a bit stronger. The nights get longer, it gets colder, all that kind of thing. It marks the start of winter. That's what the equinox is.
So, come the early hours of Saturday morning,
yes,
we'll have, equal hours, we can count them, equal hours of day and night.
That's it, yeah. Now, it's about 12 hours for the day and 12 hours for the night. Now, if you're a pedant, you might point out that it's not exactly the same because there's a few effects that actually make the day a few minutes longer than the night. But really, unless you're sitting there with a stopwatch from dawn till dusk, you know what I mean, you're not going to notice it. Basically, the day and the night are the same length.
Okay. And is it the same at spring as it is at autumn?
That's right, yeah. The spring equinox is the same. It's the same. The day is the same length as the night. That's around March 20th or 21st. That's when the spring equinox is.
And what are we going to notice from now on out?
Right, well, we'll notice that winter, essentially it marks the start of the winter, so the nights start getting longer, it gets colder, the days are a good bit shorter, you know, it's the start of the winter season between October and up to March of next year.
Eggs and equinoxes.
Eggs, yes. I read a myth, actually, that apparently in Europe there's an old story that if you get an egg and you balance it on its narrow end, you know, the pointier end, on the day of the equinox, it will stand up, I've heard. Now, to me it sounds like a good way of making omelette, but you know, you could try it out. Any budding experimenters on Saturday morning next might want to try it out.
Okay, that's a quantum experiment for
exactly
for Saturday. Emily, thank you. Gerry Fleming, if I can turn to you. Is there really such a thing as equinoctial weather?
The term equinoctial gales is well known, but in fact, looking at the records, there is no particular time around about September, around about the equinox, or indeed in the spring equinox, when gales are especially prevalent. We get more gales in the winter than we get in the summer. The wind is stronger in the winter than it is in the summer. And that's got to do with the way the weather systems move back and forth over the face of the globe as the seasons change.
But it has been pretty windy this week.
It's been pretty windy this week. And maybe that's one of the clues, if you like, to why this phrase became commonly known. Because at this time of the year, we do occasionally get quite severe storms from the tail end of hurricane activity. Hurricane activity peaks usually in late August, early September, into late September sometimes, and those hurricanes, some of them dissipate over the United States and so on, but some of them come back around the Atlantic and come to us in the westerly flow and give us some nasty weather, as we are going to have, I think, tonight. So that may well be the reason why this time of the year got associated with unusually strong winds.
So it's more that it's a coincidence with the hurricane season,
with the hurricane season
after the summer. Jerry, some of the big hurricanes, remind me of them.
Most people will remember Hurricane Charlie, which was, first of all, I should say none of these are actually hurricanes by the time they reach Ireland, because they're not tropical storms. A hurricane is a particular tropical weather phenomenon, and they've lost their tropical characteristics by the time they get to us. But Debbie, which arrived in September 1961, will be remembered by those of a certain age and older, because the wind speed records at a number of our stations up along the west coast, at Malin Head, which has a wind speed record going back over 100 years, at Shannon Airport, places like that, those were set during Hurricane Debbie. We had wind gusts of 98 miles an hour. In fact, what happened was the chart, the pen went off the top of the chart. So,
right. So we don't know.
We don't know.
Okay.
Debbie was a particularly nasty one.
Right, Debbie. And Hurricane Charlie, of course, was another one.
Charlie was in August and it brought more rain. It wasn't a wind event, really, but it brought intense rain to parts of the east of the country. But one of the interesting things about these hurricanes is that they're not the sort of hurricanes that will affect the US. What happens to them is they move across the Atlantic from east to west in the trade winds, the easterly flow, and then they recurve or turn to the right, turn to the north very early. So they never make landfall on the other side of the Atlantic. They recurve, they come up around the top end of the Azores anticyclone, get caught up in the westerlies and swept back over Ireland. So the ones that we remember are not the ones that are remembered on the far side.
And very quickly, what's left of Hurricane Gordon, or Tropical Storm Gordon, as I should call him?
Sweeping up over the country tonight, going to bring some very strong winds to the east and south of the country, and some very heavy rain as well.
Emily Duffy, Jerry Fleming, thank you.
Thank you.
Just time to mention one other news item that caught our eye in the Quantum office. It's the discovery of a 3.3 million year old fossil of a 3-year-old girl discovered in Ethiopia over the past few years. And she's been named Salem, or Salem, Peace. She's the oldest and most complete early hominid skeleton ever found. And it's thought to be from the same species as Lucy, who you might remember was discovered in the same part of Ethiopia about 30 years ago. But Salem is nearly 150,000 years older. And that discovery appeared in this week's edition of the journal Nature. That's it for this week. To enter our iPod Nano competition, you can write to us at The Quantum Leap, RTE Radio, Donnybrook, Dublin 4, or you can email quantum@rte.ie, and you'll find links to more information about the items in this week's programme on our programme website at rte.ie/radio1/quantum. Until next week, Slán tamall.